Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate.
Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopelessness, the meager food, the soul forgot. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron.
Show tonight on Silver Time. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Philippian. It is time to light this candle. We've got a 4-1 lead in the seventh inning, bottom of the sixth. I'll be okay. At Citi Field, Mets over Phillies, and up in Boston, it is 6-3 Red Sox as they go for their seventh straight over the Evil Empire. It's a beautiful thing. Life is good. Okay, so the baseball situation is handled. We're a minute into the show. We got lots of stuff to talk about tonight, and hopefully you're going to be getting your ears on this thing live and calling in, participating any way you can, because the show is going to be a little controversial tonight. We're going to be getting into some behind-the-scenes discussions about the chiropractic profession in particular, with our guests in a couple of minutes. But first, the ever-present, ever-threatening, ever-interesting swine friend. Yes. Remember last week, it was affecting my team, the Mets. They were suspecting a member of the crew had the swine flu on the TV producing side, and they made that sucker drive home from Pittsburgh. Half the team was laid up in bed, and suddenly kind of dropped off the radar. But today, the WHO, not Daltrey and Townsend and those guys, but the World Health Organization, is gearing up to declare the swine flu pandemic, which could trigger a large-scale production of vaccines. But, of course, then the question is raised why this step was delayed for weeks as the virus spread. So here's a little report tonight coming to us from USA Today, where the news is fit to print. On Wednesday, the chief of the WHO, I always think of Daltrey, Dr. Margaret Chan, quizzed eight countries. How do you quiz a country? With large swine flu outbreaks to see if a pandemic or a global epidemic should be declared. She had a teleconference, and they're going to decide with all their flu experts tomorrow. So beware. We're in phase five of the pandemic alert, which goes to six. I'm not sure when they start to justify their own existence for producing a vaccine, but once she gets indisputable evidence, they'll make the announcement. It'll be the first flu pandemic in 41 years since the Hong Kong flu of 1968. So there's your swine friend report for the week. Unfreaking believable. Hey, so hopefully we're going to get into a lot of that sort of neo-political stuff with our guests, because really that's what it comes down to. Healthcare has become the sort of the canary in the coal mine when it comes to all of these policies, whether they be economic, whether they be academic, whether they be scientific. We're basically going to be able to know if we can afford to live the way we're living based on the way we reform healthcare. And the hilarity to me is that they think drugs are going to solve the problem. More than we need, more and better drugs. And then we'll have a better world. So hopefully between that and other topics we're going to be touching on with our guests, we're going to get into some of the more international flavon of those issues. Because I think it's getting to the point where people just want the truth. And no matter how many times you tell them, no matter how many times you show them that you got a point at yourself, don't rely on the system. Do not rely on the system. The government is never going to protect you enough. They're going to protect you, but not enough. All right? The educational system is not going to make you smart. They're not going to make you smart enough. They're going to try and make you smart. Right? That's all they're supposed to do. Teach you stuff. See if you learn it. You know, they push you through. That's why you got so many kids going through the mainstream system that are functionally illiterate. And then, of course, you have the healthcare system, which is supposed to try and keep you healthy, but not healthy enough. So there you go. So don't rely on the system, because if you do, you're going to fall between the cracks, and you're going to end up as one of the statistics that you see that the World Health Organization is trying to take care of. My fan goes bazooey here. I don't understand that. And we're going to get into those issues, because I really think that this show is unique in its forum, because it makes the onus on you, the listener, on you, the archiver, on you, the non-professional, to take it to the streets and demand this from your practitioner, your educator, your government official. Say, you know what? I want the responsibility. Give me the keys to the car, Dad. I want to drive myself. Because you're driving me off a cliff, Mr. Magoo. So I don't know what's going on. Anyway, the number again to call here tonight to blab with me is 646-478-4847. Take your calls about anything and everything. Hopefully we'll have, like I said, we'll have a raging discussion with our guests in a couple of minutes about all those things we mentioned and more. Because, you know, we're talking to a couple of radicals tonight, a couple of people that have broken free, and now they have become the bench setter or the bench marker or the pace setter or something like that when it comes to health education. They have actually broken through the paradigm and are resetting the bar for others, which is a nice thing to do if you've been on the outside looking in for most of the time you've been in practice. I mean, when I got into chiropractic, oh, my God, it feels like a zillion years ago. Can you imagine what the world was like in 1991? 1991. All right? We're talking extremely different world. And, you know, it's a long time ago now. It's 18 years ago. But when you go back there and you see what's going on then, what's going on now, very similar contexts. You know, we had that little recession there in the early 90s, the old junk bond thing, just like we're having now, a little deeper. Okay? Everything's a little, the numbers are a little different, but it's the same kind of feeling. And the healthcare industry, again, was in reform. They were trying to reorganize themselves around the corporations at that point. They were just going completely overt with it. And managed care healthcare organizations, HMOs, all that was the rage. And, of course, the chiropractors were on the outside looking in, just like they are now. And what you notice is that, unlike in previous eras, the profession back then sort of had a little bit of a core sort of voice to itself, because we were fresh from the battle between the AMA and Chester Wilk and his buddies that we won. We actually beat the AMA. The chiropractors beat the AMA for 10 years. They beat them in 1987. They battled, and Chester Wilk and three of the chiropractors beat the big bad AMA, and the AMA was forced to make several, you know, concessions that, hey, you know what, we're out to get you guys, and we don't really like you guys, and we told people not to cooperate with you guys, and things like that there. And so for that little interval there between 88 and 92 in there, they went away and they came up with things like physiatry and nurse practitioners and primary care provider and network doctors and all things like that. These systems that were put into place to basically screen us out, because chiropractors, you know, they used to be general practitioners in the MD side, right? And then at a certain point, and once the GP went away, you had options that were taken over by like things like, oh, I don't know, 24-hour drugstores, things like that. And so you had urgent visit and things like that, but you didn't have that general practitioner that just took care of you, independent of your symptoms and your conditions, and just kind of basically was there for you to answer questions. The pediatrician became much more of a paper pusher, and still is, for the most part, and, you know, administers things like vaccines, things like that for the kids. But for the most part, there's nothing proactive about their care. So the chiropractors were put in place, in the new model as tertiary rehab.
Now, what the hell is that?
Well, that means before and after surgery, you have pre-op and post-op. That was what the PTs did. And then if there was something in between, something extra, chiropractor can do something for you for about a month. And that was that. All right, so I see our first guest has dialed in. We should have our second one here in a minute. So anyway, getting a little off track here. What I want to do is set the context for you is that if you go back to 91 and look at where the chiropractic profession was then and where it is now, you're not going to see much difference from the outside, but from the inside. There's been a massive amount of change, and hopefully we're going to get into a little history lesson here with our guests in a couple of minutes. And I'm waiting for Pete to call in here before I pop them both up. Anyway, I will be doing three or four things at once here as I look around. And I want to set the context for you guys, the listener tonight, to understand one thing. The things we're going to be discussing on the show tonight pertain to one model of one way to get out of this sort of, system-dependent orientation. And your personal independence, both as a human being and as a citizen, all that stuff, really relies on action. And there's been so little action on the professional side, and you've seen so many support groups and so many things rise up the last three or four years from different causes, whether it's the Autism Speaks crowd or Dan or all these things that have risen up because parents have had enough. They want better choices. They want their options put in front of them. They want the damn truth. And unfortunately, you still get to this day naysayers. There was an article a couple of days ago, I forget, was it Newsweek magazine? One of them just basically took Oprah to task for putting out all these alternatives, on the mainstream TV on a daily basis because, God forbid it's not allopathic, so therefore it's no good. And I'm just concerned. I'm just concerned that, for the most part, that people are it's almost like they're not given the benefit of the doubt that they can make choices for themselves. So anyway, I'm going to pop up Dr. Malul here. We'll see if Pete's going to join us here. All right. Let me get my trusty horn. I can find her. There you are. All right. So joining us now from Sumo, Dr. Robert Malul. Welcome to Somatime.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right. Oh, there he is. Coming in second, but not far behind. There he is. Dr. Pete Scott.
Hey, man. What's going on? How are we doing?
All right, you're on there. Okay, so I was just kind of riffing there for a minute while you guys were getting over to the show, is that if you took a snapshot of chiropractic, say, 1990, around there, between the Wilk case and Hillary Care, somewhere in there, before Mercy, said it, just to talk out of in complete chiro lingo here for a minute, and you took a snapshot of it today, what, and I got into practice in 91, and when you look at things from the standpoint of a healthcare consumer, I love that phrase, their choices back then were basically major medical, workers' comp, personal injury, the garden variety stuff. And now, because of network, out of network, this is a covered, previous condition. If you're a parent of a child that is in early intervention, and you want to go alternative, you don't want to do the drugs, you don't want to do the traditional route. And you go to the clinical model and you dial up chiropractic. I'll start with you, Dr. Miller. What is the option? You open the yellow pages and it's the same old danger signals that have been there for 40 years. What are the options for a parent in terms of what's the difference? What's the improvement between 20 years ago and now, before the outbreak of all these conditions?
That's a good question. And the fact is, in any model, whether you look at traditional medicine or the educational system, the fact is that, the way that we look at these problems and the way that they're treated and the way that they're addressed, it really hasn't changed in 50 years. That's when stimulant medication and some basic behavioral modification came on the scene, and it really hasn't changed since. So, and even in the healthcare model, there really isn't much of a healthcare model for it because, the insurance companies don't want to pay for anything. So they basically don't treat these problems as medical conditions, because up until just recently, they haven't looked at a lot of the other problems that go along with autism and ADHD and other disabilities as being part of the problem. They've looked at it as coincidental. So if a child has digestive problems or immune problems or motor or sensory issues, those are purely coincidental, And they looked at these as purely psychiatric or psychological or really more educational problems. So, you know, there really even hasn't been much of a medical model that has existed for parents other than, you know, yes, we'll give them a medication. But, you know, medication doesn't work for autism. It doesn't work for dyslexia. It doesn't work for learning disabilities. And it really doesn't work for ADHD other than to just manage symptoms. So, you know, really the options have been limited, and even today they're very, very limited. And, you know, fortunately, I think we're making a difference in that.
Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, if you go backwards, back then, big bellwether issue as a chiropractor was that, you know, we were basically from the point of, I don't know, maybe Pete can testify to this because he was there during the Sid Williams era. That chiropractors were, it was a knee-jerk, it's your anti-vaccine. They didn't always tell you why. You know, you had that vitalistic standpoint. You know, but this is before the outbreak of you know, all the things that happened in the last 20 years in the ASD spectrum. What are the options now? You go to a chiropractor, you ask them point blank, what's your stance on these issues? And for the most part, clinically, have they done the work to justify their position, or are they still just coming from a philosophical, you know, viewpoint? Well, Pete answered that as coming new into the profession the last 15 years or so.
I believe that most of the clinical practice out there in terms of probably pediatric aspects is probably more philosophical. I don't know if I think the area of functional neurology, clinical neurology, and the work that Dr. Mullo and Dr. Fred Carrick have pioneered over the last 25 years has allowed a certain subpopulation of the profession to learn more about neurodevelopment of the brain and looking at, as Dr. Mullo was talking about, the sensory and motor functions of a child. But I mean, I would still think that the primary mode of pediatric care, if you want to use that term in clinical practice, is probably more subpopulation-based, adjust the spine, adjust a postural aspect, but not of a large percentage of the profession understanding that adjustment for a postural abnormality, i.e. a subluxation, would have huge consequences on brain development, specifically sensory motor drive to the brain, which is going to allow, obviously, children to achieve higher cognitive and academic skills. So I think that maybe at best a small percentage of the profession, and I think when you talk to people that go out and get the advanced degrees in chiropractic neurology, functional neurology, heck, there's probably less than 1,000 practitioners. And I think, you know, Dr. Rob's only taught about 1,000 practitioners out of, what, 120,000, 130,000 chiropractors worldwide? So, I mean, again, you're talking about a very small subpopulation of clinicians.
So we go through a decade of in the 70s and 80s, that 20-year generation where there's a lot of evidence about psychoneuroimmunology. We go through a decade of neuroscience, or even 30 years of neuroscience, decade of the brain being the 90s. All this evidence piling up all around us that we can influence the tonality of our nervous system, the functional level of our nervous systems, yet the clinical applications are pretty much, you know, as you say, they're still in the rudimentary phase. Why do you think it's just bureaucracy or the fact that there's not enough people to teach it? What do you think is the rate limiting step? I'll start with Dr. Mullo.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the fact is that although there was a lot of research in all those areas, there weren't people that were really integrating it and looking across different professions. So that you had people in the biochemical, you know, nutrition model, you have people in the psychology, neuropsychology, you have, you know, people in the postural, sensory motor area, but there wasn't anybody really that could look at all of it and say, how does it actually interrelate? Because we still didn't really have a really good understanding of how a lot of sensory motor function and postural-related aspects related to the brain and how the brain related to control of the immune system and the autonomic system and how they all interrelated together. So, you know, you had the people in the sensory motor world that were looking at separate things like OTs and PTs, and even today still look at, you know, fine motor and gross motor problems, or look at vision problems, or look at auditory problems, but don't look at that as how they relate to one another. And then you have people in the biochemical world that look at the nutrition and the dietary and the immune and the digestive functions, but have no idea really about the brain or the nervous system. And the people that really know a lot about neuroscience or neuropsychology don't know anything about the body and how that relates to the brain. So I think that we had a lot of good research out there, but it wasn't integrated. And, you know, I think until you know, we started developing a lot of the models that we have that Dr. Carrick started in the chiropractic neurology. And then, you know, that was really what I spent the last 15 years doing, was really trying to say, how does this all relate? Because it's got to all fit together somewhere. And there's got to be, you know, one kind of thing that really directs it all. And, you know, that's what I wrote my textbook about, which was really a search to kind of understand on the most scientific level how they all interrelate to one another. You know, and it's really interesting when we look at, you know, why we have brains and how it relates to posture, and the fact that humans have unique brains and that we also have a unique posture and a unique motor strategy with bipedalism, and how that relates to our digestive function, and that our digestive system is different than any other species of animal, and how it evolved around the same time as our brain started to evolve. And, you know, looking at how all of this stuff does actually relate to one another. And, you know, people are just starting to kind of get that. But what to do about it, and even now, you know, one of the first questions I ask when I go out to any sort of clinical or parent or educational group that I lecture to, I say to them, you know, what is the actual problem in the brain that you're trying to fix? What's the primary problem? And most people have no idea. They can't answer that at all. And that's a problem.
And so back to Pete for a second. You made it your purpose during your education as a chiropractic, which you actually educated a lot of chiropractors in the process of getting your own, is that when you look at the nervous system, the way it's organized and the way that it develops, what do you think is the essential missing, as he says, the missing ingredient? What is it that people are aware of, even on the academic side, so that they can go address it clinically that you've been able to uncover?
I mean, it might be the pothole in the educational system of the clinical chiropractor at the chiropractor level. Is that, again, are we, I think as a profession, we've always kind of taken an isolation standpoint, is that we are chiropractors, and you hear the Fred Barges and Sid Williams of the world say that, you know, chiropractic is chiropractic, you know, with IC, and never looking at, like Dr. Rob saying, all these other great disciplinaries that are out there, they were all looking at the nervous system. They all, I remember one time sitting, I was invited to go and lecture to Dan Murphy's class at Life West, and back in 2004, and one of the experiments I did was, I just put a little box out there, put a little item, and I had punched a bunch of holes in it, and I had the kids look through one hole at a time and draw, you know, write down what they saw. And obviously everybody saw a different angle, and that was chiropractic, and that's the techniques, that's the different aspects of, well, we do this, I do this. But again, looking at psychoneuroimmunology, looking at neuroscience, looking at developmental biology, that educational aspect hasn't transposed to the clinical applications and educational systems in chiropractic. And I think that's the big missing link, and that's why so many chiropractors, when they come out of school, they go, well, you know, I'm just going to treat ADHD and I'm going to treat autism with a chiropractic adjustment. As we now know, obviously an adjustment has a huge amount of potentiation on brain activity, but knowing when to do it, how to do it, at the specificity that Dr. Melo and Dr. Carrick have developed over the last 25 years, I think that's what has to happen on a large scale for us to make a huge dent in this epidemic that we're seeing worldwide.
And you guys coined a phrase. It's kind of funny how, you know, two vitalistic guys has had to use a sort of an allopathic or even a pathogenic term, like, you know, that will kind of tie together a lot of these things. I had an author on, not sure how long ago, maybe a couple months ago, that wrote a book called The Alphabet Kids, which said that, you know, you take these 70-odd neurobehavior disorders and, you know, he just, as an academic guy, he just listed all the overlap of them. You might even know about him, Dr. Miller. His name's Robert Walliver. And,
yeah, I know him very well, actually. He's here on Long Island.
Okay, yeah. And basically, he created a handbook for parents so that they can get services, because he said rather than settle for one label, try and get seven or eight for your kid, because the way the system is set up, it's set up to treat the labels, not the kid. So if your kid's only diagnosed as, you know, say he's diagnosed as a low-functioning LD kid, well, he might have other issues, and then he's only going to get so many services, you know, for his LD condition, but he's not going to get something else for maybe his auditory processing problem or whatever. And you start dealing with so many parts of the puzzle that the kid is essentially just a paperwork trail, and they're not educating the evolving child. And unfortunately for the parents, they learn this as they go, and they don't learn this ahead of time, and they're sort of It's sort of kind of like, you know, a pig and a poke, that you're going to get the right person in the system that's going to be able to direct them, you know, to where they need to go to get the care they need for the kid. And you guys came up with a term in your research that deals with it as a global problem. Why don't you talk about that, Dr. Miller, the process of disconnection syndrome. What does that really entail?
Yeah, well, that's actually, you know, what you talk about with his book is that, you know, this is what I kind of looked at when I was first looking at a lot of this stuff, is that, you know, there were all these children that had these separate diagnoses. But then when you look at the list of symptoms, there's such a tremendous overlap. And, you know, most of the people out there, the psychiatrists, psychologists, are out there, and their job, they look at it as just to be able to give the child a label. And if they can give them one label or two labels or three labels, they're happy. But yet again, if you ask those people, what actually does that mean as to what's happening in the brain? And you know, when you talk about all of these, they really overlap one another. And that's where, even in the research, if you really have paid attention to the research over the past 10 years or so, a lot of top researchers have been saying, you know, there's something missing. There's something that's common in all of these children, that they're not separate and distinct conditions, but they're actually all part of the same problem. And it was really hard to put the finger on what it was. Now, the term functional disconnection, we didn't really coin that. Actually, functional disconnection goes back to the turn of the 19th century, where, you know, neurologists first started to notice that, you know, you could have injury to the white matter of the brain that would disconnect areas of the brain that looked just like injury to the gray matter of the brain. But yet it didn't involve the gray matter. It just involved communication between areas of the brain. Later on in the 40s, neuropsychologists started noticing that children would have all the same symptoms of a disconnection syndrome, which is what that was previously called, but yet there was no injury, actual physical injury, to white matter or gray matter. But yet it seemed to involve the same thing with poor communication between areas of the brain, and that became known as a functional disconnection. So we've actually known about this for quite some time, but it's only been, you know, the few years since my textbook came out and since a few other researchers have really been doing it, that now it's become the leading theory in the world right now for autism or ADHD. And basically what it says is that it doesn't matter what the label is. What we're looking at is what's actually happening in the brain. And what's happening is that there is this imbalance between large cortical networks where there's a timing issue. It's not just this spatial problem where you have injury in a particular part of the brain, but that there's actually a temporal component, that there's poor coordination between these areas of the brain. And because of that, they can't communicate, they can't share, they can't integrate information. So when you can't get all these areas of the brain online at the same time, certain areas get dropped out. And when certain areas get dropped out, those areas of the brain don't mature, they don't grow, they don't develop, and then the other areas actually end up growing too fast and too much, and you get this imbalance or this unevenness of skills. And that's one of the things that has stood out, is that, you know, these children, we know that they don't have any degeneration or injury or destructive process in their brain at all, that certain areas of their brain just look immature, and that they have this unevenness of skills, so that certain skills are way below their age, but other skills are significantly above their age. And see, that's the thing that, you know, you really have to look at, because a lot of the other models out there don't explain that, or don't, like when you look at a toxin or something like that, it really can't explain that situation.
Well, one of the things that that really got my interest early on was this notion of neuroplasticity. There's so many directions to go just from that term alone, but for the most part, when I got into chiropractic college in the late 80s, nerve cells died. They didn't get plastic. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it was a board question. It was like, you know, if you said that nerve cells, you know, regenerated and had the ability to be plastic and stuff, and you were a Martian. And literally, by the time I got in the field and got out there practicing, and Carl Perbin's hologramic brain model was out there, and you got into the mid-90s when you started seeing application of this, like Schwartz's work with OCD, neuroplasticity became almost like commonplace. How much of that sort of direction and sort of just focus and research has been applied to your model? in terms of neuroplasticity applying it.
Neuroplasticity, you're absolutely right. I mean, not only was it believed that the brain was pretty much fixed and couldn't change, but
right.
we were also, even until just fairly recently, were told that you could never grow new brain cells in,
mm-hmm.
as an adult. Now we know not only is the brain incredibly plastic, you know, not just in children, not just in that window of 0 to 3, which people were saying even just like 10 years ago, but
mm-hmm.
that it's just as plastic now, but that even neurogenesis, that now we know that you can actually create new brain cells in human adult brains. That's been well documented. So that, you know, now it adds a whole nother possibility, and basically what it says is that the brain is never broken. I mean, there's no way that the brain, you know, is permanently damaged beyond repair of some level. And, you know, the stroke model at this point is really a beautiful model. You know, I'm also doing a lot of work in neuropsychology and working with brain injury. And, you know, a few years ago, if somebody had a stroke in left half of their brain and lost the right arm, that was it. After a year, neurologist said, that's it. There's nothing else that could happen.
Right.
And then a few years ago, somebody came up with a therapy called constraint-induced movement therapy.
Yeah, they
and
tie the good arm down and make you use
right.
the other one? Yeah.
Exactly. Make them use the bad arm. And
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, a person who would have been disabled for the rest of their life now could gain almost full use of that arm back. And now it's being applied in speech therapy. So to a cognitive skill, we see the same thing, constraint-induced speech therapy, which is the same thing. They make them use words and don't allow them to use nonverbal communication. And the same thing, we see people who would have been typically never been able to speak again for their whole life, now they're gaining back almost full levels of speech. So, you know, there's a whole new world out there, and that's why nothing gets me angrier than when people automatically say, well, these kids are incurable. There's nothing you can do about it. And it's ridiculous, because if you really know the literature, if you understand the genetics or epigenetics, and if you understand brain plasticity, it's just a foolish statement.
And it's funny, because to me, it took the profession almost 100 years, in chiropractic anyway, to just get to the point where we became a rock in the shoe of the allopathic establishment. And now you're looking at 10 years later, you guys... are now in this achievement model you've created in the educational world, are a rock in the shoe of the chiropractors who are still stuck in the orthopedic model, and they're not recognizing the role of the nervous system. So how has it been in the last, say, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, bringing something that you would think the profession would embrace and finding out that you've had to kind of slowly shoehorn your way in to the consciousness of the profession at large and the field in general? I guess Pete, as is coming from student to doctor, would be the first one to answer that one, because he was coming to me, you know, 10 years ago with piles of books like, you know, Scott Ladeau and like, why won't they listen? I go, because they're chiropractors, they don't want to think. So Pete,
well, again,
give me your spin on that, because I got to get you got to get it out here.
I just think it comes back to is a lot of chiropractic mindset. When I think we went into the early 80s and we went into managed care, and everybody got into a rehabilitation model, but a lot of people got just stuck on the more of the orthopedic rehabilitation model and not necessarily the neuro-rehabilitation model. And I think that the only branch of chiropractic again that broke that trend was started by Dr. Carrick and all his disciples. And so when only one fragment of that profession was really saying, okay, listen, we're applying the greatest and best brain plasticity research that's coming out from, you know, guys like William Taub and Schwartz and Kendall and all these guys that are out there talking about the brain that changes itself. I mean, I'm never shocked when you see books now like Dan Amen's book or Norm Dodge's book that's out there. But heck, the chiropractic neurology group was saying that 20 some odd years ago, 25 years ago, and it's amazing to me that most of our profession just hung tight to, I think, that old philosophy that, you know, not nerve, you know, hard compression model of a subluxation, and not looking at, you know, joint neurology, not looking at muscle spindle neurology, and understanding, again, the postural system, the vestibular system, the oculomotor system, and its driving functions of brain activity. And that's not what's getting trickled down to the student. It's still not at a large degree. I mean, you go and take a chiropractic neurology course in this country, and even attend Dr. Milo's classes, there's only 30, 40 practitioners. sitting in it. You know, and Life University is one of the largest chiropractic colleges now in the country, and our classes here in Atlanta, they're maybe 60, 70 people. Yet there's, what, 2,500 new chiropractic students at that university, and you talk to other universities and schools. So, again, is it apathetic on the students? Is it apathetic on the administration? Is it apathetic on the faculties? Who knows? But the reality of it, yet in the era that we are, it's amazing to me that most of my colleagues or future colleagues are still stuck in this pop and pray mindset of, you know, adjust and Nate's going to provide everything kind of thing.
Well, just speaking as someone kind of in the middle of you guys, because I've been both a student, a teacher, a practitioner, and an instructor, and the politics alone have definitely a role to play of why certain types of information got put in the pipeline and other types didn't. And the other type, I think, is just pragmatic, because the field was really kind of awash in a lot of as you said, these mindsets, but they were sort of fostered by academic survival of information. It was like you had to justify everything. You got to remember, in the 90s, it was like you had to sort of justify every single thing you were doing to make sure that you were going to get repaid. Because in the 80s, you had $100 deductibles, unlimited care. All of a sudden, they're capping everything, and they want reports, and they want this, and they started to litigate, and they started to go crazy with, you had an X-ray this guy, and this. And so you had to practice extremely defensively. So you're going to rely on the most obvious thing, which is your orthopedic, neurological stuff, and the stuff that's basically the most pathological in the case, and the things that are functional and kind of wiggly and not really even symptomatic, they're just kind of pattern-oriented, they were too soft. There wasn't enough evidence to really justify care for that. But the thing is that, like, from the standpoint of what the profession offered people, yeah, you had chocolate and vanilla. You had the more medically oriented chiropractic that was more interested in treatable conditions, you know, strains, sprains, things like that. I used to call it strains, sprains, and automobiles. And the other part was dealing with the sort of subluxation lifetime care, more the box on the wall kind of practice. And in the middle was the pistachio nut being me, and I was talking about things like attention and memory and states of consciousness. And of course, then I got into heart physiology and neurocardiology and heart rate variability, which led me into a whole different genre. But the thing was is that information that was sitting on the walls and borders, 10, 15 years ago, was there for all the professions to take from. And it seemed like psychology took to it the most. And they were able to advance it and advance their own profession. And other ones, like the fitness industry, exercise physiologists weren't thought of as much, 10, 20 years ago. Now they're PhDs. I just think the structure of the profession was such that all we were doing was everybody was in the school business, and they were just trying to graduate the most students as possible, get the most alumni, to create the most new students and so on. And they weren't thinking ahead. They weren't thinking about how it was going to happen 10 or 15 years ago, and they were never going to think about what was going to happen in terms of the field at large with this new information. So now that we're here, now that we're in this post managed care era now, and things are starting to dry up on the insurance level, you guys decided to say, you know what, we're not going to take this information and make it into another chiropractic technique like Ted did and suffer the apathy and the resistance and the just you're talking about there. You took it directly to the parents of the children that are out there suffering, and you took it into a model that's more on the academic side. So tell me about the infrastructure of that. How did you do it? What was the kitchen table conversation about that? I guess this is back to you, Dr. Rob.
Yeah, well, just to get back to the last statement just for a second, just because it was a really good point, I think. Two interesting stories quickly. One was we were just at the Autism One conference with another colleague, Jeremy Fritz, who has a center in Chicago. And we were there, which is probably at this point now the largest conference in the world. And a couple of years ago, with Jeff Bland, a woman named Martha Herbert, who I really respect, I consider her to be one of the best there is. She's a pediatric neurologist out of Harvard, and she goes against the mainstream all the time, and she's right most of the time, but she's also a brilliant woman. And she had commented to Jeff Bland that she thought my textbook was one of the best textbooks that was out there. So, I thought that was pretty neat. And so I had the opportunity to meet her, and we walked up to her, and Jeremy had the textbook in his hand with my most current book, Disconnected Kids. she saw the book before she even saw us or knew anything about us. She said, that's one of the best books I've ever read. She said, that is the most forward-thinking book I've read in 10 years, and that should be required reading for everybody at this conference.
Hmm.
On the other hand, you know, and also I know that colleagues of mine have told me that they go into UCLA Medical School and my textbook is there. Now, on the other hand, I know that Ted Carrick was telling me that when I came out with Disconnected Kids, you know, it's a best-selling book. It's being, you know, getting great reviews in all professions across the world. And he, you know, tried to get the ACA to kind of support it. And he actually told me something that blew me away. They asked him what the MDs thought about it, which to me was just unbelievable, you know, just like, wow, that's incredible. But, you know, the fact is the MDs love it, the psychology world love it, and it, you know, I think I'm a little biased, but I think my textbook should be required reading at every chiropractic college. But yet it hasn't been, you know, we haven't embraced the resources that we have within our own groups. With that, to take on to your last question, it was, you know, we really looked at starting a model that didn't want to directly compete with chiropractors. We really didn't want to have a clinical model for a number of reasons. One is from a liability standpoint. We didn't want to deal with insurance companies. And really, our goal was to get children to learn at a normal level. And it was really more of an educational goal than a health-related goal per se. But the fact is, you know, these children don't learn in a traditional way. You needed to use a non-traditional approach. And we knew that the hemispheric model, that the functional disconnection was the problem. So you needed to develop an educational approach that incorporated dealing with the primary problem as well as then educating the child. And they needed to be educated on every level. They needed to be educated in how to move their body and how to process sensory information auditorily and visually and tactily and smell. But you can't get the brain to grow and develop if the child has food sensitivities and vitamin and mineral deficiencies and toxins around their body. So, you know, you can't really separate it. How can you teach a child, like, you know, even a regular teacher, a regular child, if the child hasn't eaten breakfast, you know? You need to be able to incorporate everything. You need to use a truly holistic model to educate children. And we really looked at it as something that would be a complement to our colleagues who are chiropractic neurologists who didn't have the means or the ability to spend an hour with each child, to be able to hire teachers to work with them. So we looked at it as really something that could support somebody, where they could still do their adjustments and do their chiropractic treatment, and yet they knew that they needed more, but they could send to some place that understood the hemispheric model and that would address all of the issues and work with them. At the same time, doing the same thing with schools.
Now, just go throw it back to people that haven't heard it yet. Why don't you give us like a 90-second overview of what the hemispheric model is, and you know, when you're looking at a kid that's coming in with obvious delays, you know, some of the things they might see, right, left hemisphericity, you know, just give people a basic idea of what they're looking at.
Again, I mean, the whole premise is obviously the functional disconnection, the imbalance of the timing mechanism between the two hemispheres. And, you know, some of the things you can look at immediately is you look at, like Dr. Malo touched on, fine motor activation versus gross motor activation. We know the right hemisphere does most of the dominant of the gross motor activity and the postural activity. The left hemisphere does more fine motor activity. You can look at an academic profile of a child. You can measure reading comprehension skills of a child versus their phonetic skills or their spelling skills or their word reading skills, which are more dominant left brain activities versus comprehension, more right brain, looking at listening comprehension. And so literally the brain balance program is designed in a very short amount of time, a 4 to 5 hour assessment, is to check every one of these different sensory motor developmental milestones and compare them right brain development to left brain development, compare the academic development, right brain development, and as Dr. Miller also touched on, that they have all these bio-nutritional deficiencies, and you can literally see the asymmetry in their nutritional status relative to the hemispheric imbalance. And the goal of the assessment process of these children is obviously to determine what hemisphere is delayed, and then the magnitude of that delay, and what particular areas in that individual child. We may have two ADHD children that have right hemisphere delays, but one may have more of a problem in their vestibular development versus their proprioceptive body space development, or their oculomotor development of their eye muscles, the coordination of their eye movements. And the same thing goes for a child with a reading delay or a child with a learning delay. So in a very short assessment process, we're able to detect that functional disconnection and then obviously create an individualized program for that functional disconnection.
No, again, thinking about it from the outside in, I'm a parent of a 7-year-old and a parent of a 15-year-old. They have different brains, adolescent brain, you know, versus a child's brain. Does the program accommodate for those developmental markers, or is it basically a sensory motor program designed to address those things you just kind of categorized for us?
Oh, the way that we've done it is that it's really individualized completely to the child at whatever age they are. And the fact is we actually break it down so that we measure a child in every skill that we look at, which are really 1,200 different data points. But we measure them, and we look at them in anywhere from a 3-year-old to a 17-year-old skill level. So what we do is we say, okay, you know, this particular skill in this particular side of the brain is functioning, let's say, at a 5-year-old level, but then another skill may be functioning, you know, in the left brain at a 15-year-old level. And so what we do is we look at the actual skill itself, and we look at all of the skills. So the chronological age of the child doesn't matter. It matters what's the functional ability of that particular skill in that particular center of the brain in that particular area of the brain. And we're looking at that and getting a complete picture of the child in every area, because you have to look at every area. You can't just focus on one area and think you're going to change the whole brain. It doesn't work that way. So we look at everything, and it really is adaptable to any child, basically from 4 or 5 years old up to 18 years old, and so that it takes into account. We've looked at, you know, all the research that says this is what a child at this level should be doing, and we use objective measurements that have been well documented in fields of education or psychology or neuropsychology or occupational therapy, physical therapy, chiropractic, and we look at those, and, you know, some of them we also develop our own measurements. And we're looking at each child based on that. And our goal is to get them to where everything basically matches, where everything is balanced, and where it's at least at their chronological age level.
And are these programs basically school year bound, or they go year round, or how does it work?
They go year round. We work with kids all year round, and, you know, we do basically 12-week programs. Where the child comes in 3 times a week for 12 weeks, and then we reevaluate them. And it really all starts with that evaluation that Peter was talking about earlier, and that's how we end. So what we're looking at is functional measurements. We're not looking at just behavioral symptoms or academic symptoms or anything. We're looking at function, and we want to measure function, and we do that periodically. And based on those changes is when we decide whether we need to move forward with the child or whether the child is done with the program. And fortunately, at this point, with the children that we move in, 90% of them at least are going to be done in either, 3 to 6 months.
Oh, okay. So they move through pretty rapidly once they get going. Well, do you guys have plans to design this for adults and seniors, or is it basically going to focus on the kids?
Well, I think that, you know, adults, like as you said, adults' brains are not children's brains. That right now the chiropractic neurologist that's out there and you know, other chiropractors and other physicians are trained in functional neurology to really look more at the individual. You know, parents come with a whole history behind them. You know, they have a lot of other stuff. They have car accidents. They have, you know, other health-related problems. They have, you know, metabolic issues. They have a lot of other things, and I think they need more of a one-on-one type of care where, you know, each person needs to go through a comprehensive evaluation, diagnostic testing, and they need to be looked at, you know, that way. Children are a little different. On one end, you know, they all have growing brains, and so you have to do things recognizing that they don't have cognitive brains yet, but they don't have as much of a history behind them.
Right,
and,
you gotta fight the memory. Yeah.
Yeah, and we can work on them together. You know, they were actually, children work better in a group setting than they do individually. So I think we're able to, you know, be a little bit, we don't have to be as focused. But when it comes to an adult, you know, the same principles apply, but I think that the typical chiropractic neurologist right now is really the best person in any health field to really deal with these types of problems on an adult level.
The reason I mention that is because I always think of Larry Katz's program with Neurobics, working with brain aging and longevity with Alzheimer's and reversing Alzheimer's with his program. If you map that up with what you guys are doing, you got both ends of the lifeline there. You're jumping rope with it. Brains on the way up, brains on the way down. It's the brains in the middle that are driving everybody to the centers that get lost in the shuffle. Unfortunately, we sort of swim for ourselves here in the middle of the curve, but. I just think that, like I said, the degree and extent that you guys have gone to organize this thing is remarkable. I'm just amazed that the public acceptance and even the professional acceptance of the general principles of the program are still in that sort of early phase of what? Are you sure? Double check. And you guys are going through basically what you told me there is you're operating at a level that like an NIH clinic would operate at to justify your care. And yet, like Pete says, 50, 60 kids showing up to get the information at the school, you know, a smattering of kids in the club and at life there. What is it that makes this stuff so unpopular if it's so successful and is helping 90% of the kids progress so quickly? What is it, just that you have to think? Is that the problem?
You mean unpopular from a standpoint?
Yeah, to kind of private colleges and even just a bit to get practitioners in general to pay attention to it, you know, as not even a clinical modality, just as something that's a successful model, where you have, you would think people would be flocking to learn this stuff in the schools, and it just seems like it goes through the slowest boat possible.
Yeah, I think that it's you know, neurology is scary for most people. I mean, most doctors of any kind, I've seen it, you know, their eyes just kind of glaze over. I guess it's kind of how I used to feel about organic chemistry. You know, it's just that neurology just scares the heck out of most people, I think, and that automatically eliminates some of it. And it's also a lot of work, you know. You have to work hard. You have to actually study. You have to really go to classes. You have to dedicate. It's not just about making money. And so that eliminates a whole bunch of people as well. But the fact is, it is gaining a lot of acceptance. The book, the popular book that I have out right now, is really, you know, really gaining a lot of acceptance. But I think it also comes down to research, and that's why, you know, I'm focused right now on developing a research lab that's affiliated with university-based program in neuropsych rehab. And, you know, we're really focused on raising the money to do really world-class research. And I just came out with a new paper that'll be coming out very shortly, and I have a couple of other papers coming out this year. But I think it really is going to start with the research. I mean, once we come out with more and more outcomes data that really proves it, I think that's when you're going to see that the scientific community and the healthcare community is going to jump on top of it. My fear is that what's going to happen, and I almost see it happening now, is that neuropsychology and even medical neurology, they grasp it, and as soon as they get it, they're like, wow, this is great. And I think that they may actually jump it before the chiropractic profession does. You know, we got to wait until they, you know, find it acceptable. And at that point, you know, they're going to accept this model before anybody else does, which really would be a shame.
Yeah, and they'll claim it for their own, and the chiropractors will be outside looking in, just again, just like they were the last wave. And you guys are doing everything you can. You got that conference coming up in July down there, in conjunction with Dr. Carrick's Institute there, this super segmental conference where you guys are going to be kicking it off. And I mean, it is the bizarre world to me that Pete Skye is going to be leading anything off at Life University except protest. But it's going to happen. I hope that, you know, some news coverage of it, because believe me, there were posters on campus when he was there, and it wasn't because he was popular. Thing is, when you question the profession, especially chiropractic, there's a lot of personality involved. There's a lot of ego involved. And the one thing that the medical community has always had over the chiropractic community is that they seem to be able to admit a mistake and evolve past it in one motion, where they could take a drug off the market and put a new one out there and just keep moving. You know, allergy medications, whatever it is. Oh, this one's causing a lawsuit. Get another one out there. Fenfen's no good. Get another one out there. You know, and it's like with us, the subluxation-based model was flawed. It had huge gaps in the neurology that we've been filling in the last 25 or 30 years. And instead of saying, you know what, maybe we got to go a little higher up in the nervous system, they cut it off at the neck. They didn't let it move, and they didn't let it behave. So they didn't judge it from any angle that anyone could see it at, except, of course, when the PT said, you know what, I think I see a subluxation too. And then they got all squirrely about it. So it just seems like the profession itself, and, you know, being involved in the research community myself, coming from the outside, and you go talk to another professional, like you say, talk to psychologists or educators, or even to some of the advocates in some of the communities like that are dealing with these developmental disorders. The parents know more about these things than some of the doctors. The parents know more about the architecture of the cerebellum than some of the doctors out there, and it frightens me because it's like this is your job. It'd be like a carpenter not knowing how to, you know, difference between different tools and, you know, what nail to use. And yet they're going in there and they're going to put that kid's head in their hands and adjust them. And I'm like, wait a minute, you don't even know, you know, basically what you're trying to affect here neurologically. What are you doing? And there's no third-party insurance company that's overseeing that. That's when the lawyers, guns, and money come in. And that's why I think, like I said, that liability issue that you guys used, you saw that third rail. You said, you know what, we're not going to put this in the clinical boat because – It'll get stung. It'll get the cannonball will hit it. We'll put it over here in an academic learning environment where we're going to look at this contextually rather than comprehensively. And if something is more progressive, if something is more involved, we can always refer out to one of our chiropractic neurologists that we can trust. And it becomes a referral system and it becomes a grassroots operation, which is going to make it travel slow. I think that's what answered my own question there a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like you said, I mean, this thing that is going on in life is a great first step. I think that, you know, Dr. Reichman needs to be congratulated because, you know, I think he's a forward-thinking person in our profession, and he's actually been quoted as saying that, you know, he'd like to see every kid graduate from that school with basically a degree in functional neurology, and he's really embraced Dr. Carrick and what we're doing. And, you know, he's been able to say, listen, you know, let's look at – you know, we have our philosophy, but as you said, it's not a religion. And, you know, we have to look at it objectively through science. And if something's not working, if something's not right, we have to admit it, but it doesn't mean we were wrong. I mean, we're seeing these effects. We know that chiropractic works. We know that what we do works. So let science explain it. And if it actually contradicts what somebody's technique said that came out 50, 60 years ago, then so what? You know, let's move forward.
Something's right within limits, and then you find out another answer, and you go, okay, now we're going to go this direction. For some reason, because, again, ego and personality, you get people that will stare at the sky and insist it isn't blue when you know, everyone else knows better. That's one of the reasons why, you know, Pete was saying before, when I ask a chiropractor why he's against vaccines and he gives me a bunch of philosophy, you know, that becomes belief system-oriented instead of, like you're saying, instead of being based in science that people can objectively make a decision, which is supposed to be what I thought informed consent was all about. I've just been out of the field 18 years. What do I know?
I mean, Peter and I were just talking last time we were together, and you know, I think D.D. Palmer was one of the most innovative thinkers of the of his time. And, you know, he was talking about how, subluxations of the spine affected the brain, affected brain function. Obviously, he got somebody who couldn't hear to hear, which means that you had to affect the brain for that to happen. He was talking about biochemistry. He was talking about immunology. And I think that he would be the first one to accept what we, you know, talk about in chiropractic neurology, and he would be right there with the bandwagon. But we've taken what he said over 100 years ago, and God forbid we deviate it, but he would be the first one, I think, to accept innovation and change and go with it. You know?
He'd have been spinning people in chairs 50 years ago. Are you kidding? Edie? it's his son that would have been going crazy about it, but I digress. Anyone interested in the Supra-Segmental Conference on Chiropractic Neurology, go to life.edu/supra-segmental, and you can check out that stuff. I think it's mid-July, late July is when it is.
Yeah, it's like the last weekend in July, I think.
Yeah, okay. And again, it's open. I think it's open pretty much to the public too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's open to anybody, I think.
Yeah, okay. So, because, to me, this is just as valuable for the parent of someone that's dealing with either a delayed kid or a gifted kid that the educational system doesn't address. And you could start to tailor their nervous system's development using these tools. And again, there's a lot of hands on the elephant when it comes to this stuff. Just down the road, I was just talking to Pete before about it. Just down the road is a great community there at both Georgia Tech and at Emory that's looking at this thing. And I was just had Rushkoff on a couple weeks ago talking about neuromarketing and how the advertising companies are in on this, how they can program the brain. Every casino in the country knows how to influence neurology with the light and the oxygen. Everybody's in on this stuff. It just seems like the dopey chiropractors are standing around with their plastic spines in their hands, screaming subluxation. And it's scary that you have this much opportunity and this much resistance at the same time in the profession. And, you know, I can pat Rieckmann on the back for what he's done recently with that, getting that school from where it was when Pete was there to where it is now. But I tell you what, we put a little paper on his desk about, 4 or 5 years ago, and had a lot of this brain-based learning stuff in there. And he ran as far away from it as he could because he was just getting the job from coming home from Palmer. And that stuff was radioactive at that point. So 4 years later, I guess the porridge is just right for the old guy now. So I'll leave him be. Yeah. But anytime he wants to talk about social brain and somatic development, I'm sitting up here in Larchmont if he wants to hear about it. But I'm not waiting by the phone.
Like you said, I think it's, you know, we have resources within our profession. We have very bright people. Like I said, I mean, I'm fortunate with some of the chiropractic neurologist people like Pete and yourself, and that are just tremendous resources, some of the brightest people I know. And I go across professions now and lecture to all different professions. And we have tremendous resources. And some chiropractors are some of the best physicians I know of any kind in the world. And we have to, again, use our own resources and be able to say, if you have people out there writing books and doing lectures and doing research, then, you know, let's you know, support them and let's go out there and you know, help them out and not, you know, not just kind of stand back and wait till they meet general acceptance with everybody else.
Yeah, especially waiting for the medical community to give it it's okay and stick a big drug on top of it, because I guess that's my final framing question for the two of you here is, with all this momentum and all this stuff going, you know, the wind at your back here, going forward, if this stuff has its optimal impact on the society, how do you think it's going to shape the receptivity to educating kids and to training doctors and really ultimately overcoming the reliance on Big Pharma? I'll go to Pete first for that.
I mean, I think it's just taking the grassroots approach, parent by parent, and educating each parent and each new case that comes into any of our brain balance centers across the country, having and delivering just optimal results for that family, and then that family going out and spreading the word in their church, spreading their word to their pediatrician or whoever. And I think that's what we're seeing here in Atlanta after 2.5 years of producing reliable outcomes because of, again, these 1,200 markers that we're looking at developmentally. We're getting that momentum now where we're getting people calling us and said, you know, I was referred to you by my pediatrician, or I was referred to you by my educator, or an educator came and heard, you know, Dr. Melillo speak in Atlanta, or myself, or whoever. And so I think it's just that grassroots movement, and as the book becomes more aware out there in the public domain and encouraging people to go out and get on Amazon and buy the Disconnected Kids, that's what we're seeing. And I think, you know, again, a prime example of that was when Dr. Rob was in Michigan 2 weeks ago, just the outpouring that he got there and that new center was just phenomenal. So I just think it's just step by step. And as Dr. Rob and I have talked over, you know, the last 3 years together in our collaboration, that we knew each year was just going to be a continued developmental aspect. And the number one thing we always wanted to pride ourselves was putting the best product out there at that moment, and that our brain balance model is going to continue to evolve as the research evolves, and making it better and better, and just making it as extremely reproducible as we can, and that'll drive people to the centers, so, and to the educators, and hopefully people to see the success of brain balance will encourage more people to take the postgraduate classes at the clinical neurology level and the functional neurology aspect and get trained and maybe become brain balance owners or just become a very good, talented chiropractic neurologist or so on.
Sounds like you guys got a lot of patience. You thinking you're going to have to kind of put the car in park for about 20 years before the bus fills up and just let time be the avenger here, I guess, and just let the proof be in the pudding and walking around in Atlanta and Long Island and wherever else you guys can put down a center. And so just to kind of round it out here, what do you think is right now the number one misconception about the work you guys are doing If I'm walking in off the street to a brain balance center tomorrow, what's the biggest question I need to get answered in my head before I know kind of where I am? I'll go to Dr. Rob for that.
Well, you know, first of all, to get back to what you just said, you know, we're not really very patient. I mean, we're working very, very diligently. I mean, I've done, I think, 60 radio shows over the past 4 months and like 15 TV shows. We're going out there now, and we're committed to educating people and promoting, you know, not just what we do with Brain Balance and not just the book, but also chiropractic neurology. We believe we're going to elevate it all, and we're going to get to a momentum point where there's going to be this kind of groundswell and I believe a true paradigm shift. And I think we already see it happening. We've only been doing this for a couple of years, but even just in the past few months, we're seeing it. But I think that, you know, the biggest misconception that people have right now is when they come in, they may equate us with other things that they know. You know, they may say, oh, this is OT or PT, or they may come in and say, oh, this is nutrition. Oh, this is, you know, education or tutoring, or they may, because we're chiropractors, they say, oh, this is chiropractic. And I think that's the biggest thing. People tend to try to equate it to, you know, the most common denominator. And we're not like any of that. We're really a combination of all of them. And just because we may do things that other people do, it's really all in the way we put it together. It's really the whole philosophy and the principles that we use that are completely unique, and the way that we combine them together and the way that we combine them. We don't, you know, we haven't reinvented the wheel and come up with a completely new tool, but we've taken those tools and we're using it in a way that nobody has ever used it in the education world before. And so, you know, that's the whole idea, that sometimes it takes people a little bit more. But as you said, you know, I realized a long time ago that the easiest thing is just to go right to parents. I mean, parents are a lot smarter than people think, and parents get it right away. And now when I go out to educators, or even, you know, OTs, PTs, school psychologists, and, you know, lecturing to all those different groups, I mean, they just come away energized, because it validates a lot of what they've seen and what they've known, and we're really getting you know, a really good response everywhere we go. One of the things I have to say is I've not gotten one negative response about this book since it's been out, which is a kind of a rare thing that I'm aware of. So, you know, I think that it's going to change rapidly.
Well, I wish you guys luck with it, because believe me, I'm for everything you guys are doing. I think it's great that it's available, it's affordable to people, and then they're getting practical results, you know, like you're saying, within a 12-week period of time. Which is unheard of, and if for someone who's had a child in special needs up here in New York for as long as it's been, and had to buck the system and deal with the layers of red tape that they could put in front of you to get any kind of help. You guys are making it clear that you know, you don't have to wait for the system to make the changes. You could just create a better system. I think you guys are well on your way to doing that, and I wish you luck with it. So. Thanks for joining us here on SomaTime. Again, if anyone wants to know about it, you can contact them at Brain Balance Centers. I think it's I had the thing up here.
BrainBalanceCenters.com, right.
BrainBalanceCenters.com, that's the site. Okay, I was looking at the blog. All right, and again, anyone that has any questions for it, you can contact me at NakedSoma@gmail.com. I'll make sure that these guys get it. And thanks again for joining us tonight here on SomaTime.
Well, thank you for you know, having us, and also just raising awareness, which is really, you know, very important thing right now. So thanks a lot for your work.
Yeah, good luck on the conference, too. I definitely want to see what happens behind the scenes with that.
Yeah, that should be a lot of fun.
All right, guys. Thanks again. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Have a good night.
All right. Good night.
All right. There you go. We have been brainioed. Where is this thing? Is it sitting there? It's stubborn. I don't know. I think they're gone. Let's see. It won't hang up. Oh, I did the other button. I'm in good shape. So anyway, I just wanted to, I hope you guys got that, because that was a very, 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 very deep interview. Even though we were just kind of glossing over a lot of stuff, there's so many things and so many obstacles that were overcome to get that information out to you guys. What Dr. Mullen's work, I can attest to it. The research community in chiropractic is completely politicized. There's not a lot of money in it that circulates among the schools. Dr. Carrick's program operated basically as a rogue program. It was a postgraduate program. It was extremely difficult to get in. He moved it into the parallel to the chiropractic education and made it into a diplomat program, I think originally through Logan College out in St. Louis. And it's just evolved over the last 15 or 20 years to be something that I think ultimately will become the core chiropractic education if they ever get woken up to the fact that other disciplines are using the same basic information to teach their practitioners. So we're going to either rely on the old stuff that doesn't translate out to the field or the new stuff that does. And from the clinical standpoint, like he was saying, there's always going to be complicated cases that, that come up that are going to need an individual's clinician's attention. But for the most part, if you have kids coming into these kinds of programs early on, especially in the early intervention phase or in the early stages of their academic career when they're just learning how to learn, so to speak, and they get these kinds of tools and open up multiple intelligences, you're going to have kids that are more receptive to learning, which most kids aren't because they're fighting all these deficits and they're fighting all these undetected disconnections that these guys are talking about. So, it's like shoveling 30 inches of snow in your driveway. It's not going to get done in an hour, but if you leave it there overnight, it's going to be, you know, just a block of ice in the morning, so you might as well start digging. And believe me, these guys are digging. There's not many of them. I mean, those two guys are doing probably 85, 90% of the work to keep that brain balance center engine going, and they've been chugging along for the last 3 or 4 years now, down in Atlanta and up here in New York. So just and a couple of places out west, actually, in California. So, you know, take a look at it because I'd like to get your opinion. You guys listen to the show. You hear different experts come on. Like he mentioned that he knew Dr. Wolver and who wrote the book about the alphabet kids. From the parent side, from the practitioner side, and from the educator side, this information is vital. This information is central to these kids getting out of this black hole they're in and as soon as possible because, like I said, it is a strain on everybody involved in the family, everyone involved in that kid's educational life, and ultimately as this kid grows into an adult. So, kind of a somber and very poignant message there, really, because if you ever touch the lives of some of these kids, and I have, and believe me, I go home to one every day, it is extremely rewarding when you see these kids change because it's almost like you figured out some type of a cosmic puzzle, and the prize is more of this kid comes out, more of this kid gets to be expressed, and that's the reason why you got into this thing in the first place. If you were really interested in helping people see themselves free, you know, I know Pete for a long time now, and he's an edgy guy. He's an onto. He's a card carrying onto. He's got a little edge to him, but tell you what. A lot of truth in that guy, and you can't begrudge him that. He's not coming at this because he's faking it. He is extremely real, and Duck Miller too. I admire what these guys have done, so I want to wish them both luck. All right, we are going to the ninth inning, tied 4-4. While we were out, the Phillies scored 3 runs on a bunch of errors and a bunch of walks and a bunch of 65-foot hits like they usually do. So we're going to go tuck away and watch the ninth inning here with our teeth chattering. And we'll be back next week with a real change of pace. More brain, less pain, as we talk about brain rhythm work with a guy that you probably haven't heard of. But check it out this week on blogsoma.net on Sunday, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 9 talking more brain. I can't get enough brain this month. I'm on a brain diet, it seems like. And 2 weeks from now, we're going to get into diet a little bit with Dr. Young. I remember from Denise Murray's appearance a couple weeks ago. So we've got more brain on tap. I don't know what to tell you. Hope you like the the theme here. But we'll be back next week with more of that. Until then, this is Dr. Mark saying thank you very much for this time and your space. Be yourself and be well. Travel light. I don't know if this is going to play, but here it comes. Messiah, baby.